today's talk is given by Dr. Steve Carver of the University of Leeds, and his talk is entitled Mapping Scotland's Wild Land from Idea to Policy in 7 Years. Dr. Carver is a senior lecturer in the School of Geography at Leeds and director of the Wildland Research Institute. Known to many here through his co-authorship of one of the most popular GIS textbooks, he has more recently been in the news working with Scottish Natural Heritage on Scotland's National Wilderness Map, which made Scotland the first in Europe to produce such a detailed map of this time. And other activities also include working with the Scottish National Parks and more widely with the John Muir Trust on the UK wilderness map. Wider still is his work on the new EU wilderness map unveiled just last week at Wild 10, which is the 10th World Wilderness Conference in Spain. And actually with the wind almost out of his hair from his bike trip back from there, we're very grateful to be able to help bring Steve back to gritty urbanism here in Drummond Street, and therefore in return look forward to telling us about life beyond these walls. So, without further ado, Steve.
Thank you. I must point out the subtitle there, From Policy to Idea to Policy in 7 Years, is just a little quote from Matthew Hawkins, who's a landscape specialist at Cairngorm National Park. And he sent that to me when the National Planning Framework 3 came out. He said, take a look at section 2.20 or whatever it was. And there was wild land and mapping of wild land in the National Planning Framework. And the 7 years came from the fact that we started work on the Cairngorm National Park map in around about 2007. So at the time it was coming up 7 years. So that's where the 7 years comes from, but bear in mind that the history of the concept of wild land in Scotland goes back a lot further. In terms of a brief outline, I'll say a little bit about where this all kicked off. Developed a little bit of a timeline just to see how that development process has gone in Scotland and how it's paralleled in Europe. I'll show you some of the early work that we did and outline where we're coming from in terms of underpinning the policy. In 2002, Scottish Natural Heritage actually put pen to paper and said, this is what we're talking about in terms of wild land, and that's when we started thinking, well, what can we map this? Most of the detail and the technical detail will be in this section here about mapping wildness in the national parks, and then a little bit about how Europe suddenly awakened to this idea and started doing some work on it. I'll say a little bit about how Scottish Natural Heritage have taken this national park mapping and expanded it to the whole country at a similar resolution, and then I'll give some thoughts on future directions. Just coming back from Wild 10, I was in a lot of talks which are really inspirational. People stood up at the front and talking just to a few pictures and things, and I thought, oh yeah, great, I'll do that. I'll aid that kind of approach. And then I started putting my slides together and realised, I just can't do this. There's just too many maps and too many technical details that you really do need, death by PowerPoint for this sort of thing. I also sat through a few nice Prezi presentations, but has anybody sat through a long Prezi presentation? They tend to make you sick. Not seeing one of these things? Have a look on the web at a Prezi presentation and just flip through it. It swirls about, does stuff, and it tends to make you feel a little bit queasy. So where did it all start? For me, it was a PhD thesis, which I submitted in 91, application of multi-criteria allegation to radioactive waste disposal, which kept me in a darkened room in front of a GIS terminal for a long time. And my heart's really out there in the hills, so I hatched a plot, which at the time was an expedition to Antarctica, but I realised that was impractical and looked to Greenland instead. And so it was all kind of a desire to get out of the office. Got bored with nuclear waste disposal. Again, didn't really get me out of the office enough, so I thought, I wonder if I can apply these same methodologies using GIS and multi-criteria evaluation and fuzzy modelling techniques, and just reversing some of the attributes. So instead of looking for places close to a road, I start looking for places a long way from the nearest road. And say, well, you know, can we use GIS to create maps of wilderness in Britain? And I got some early inspiration from some key characters. These people on the right there. First of which is Bob Aitken. I don't know if anybody knows Bob, but he used to work for the CCS, Countryside Council for Scotland, and I think he left when it became SNH and has been an independent consultant looking at recreation and wildness in Scotland since, just retired. But his PhD thesis was in 1997 on wilderness areas in Scotland, and he did some, at the time, pretty innovative work mapping remoteness using native instruments, but doing it all by hand and an expert eye. The other guys, Mike McCloskey and Heather Spaulding, and I couldn't find a picture of Heather on the internet, they produced the world's first reconnaissance level wilderness map in 1989. They did that by hand again, but manually using the tactical pilotage charts provided by the US Air Force. And then the first sort of person, people really doing stuff on using GIS for mapping wilderness was Rob Leslie from ABARES, it's the Australian Bureau of Agriculture and Rural Enterprise, whatever, I can't remember what the US stands for on the end. And they developed the Australian National Wilderness Inventory, and that was a raster-based GIS system looking at mapping wilderness in Australia. So those three characters are important to me. I just had lunch and a beer with Bob. I remember when the first time I showed some of the maps, it was down at a conference on wilderness Britain, Milton Keynes of all places. But Bob said to me, he said, Stephen says it's not empty, it's emptied. And this was a point I suddenly started thinking, yeah, there's a real cultural undercurrent to this kind of thing I'm trying to do in these parts of, in this part of the world. So do bear in mind that a lot of the maps that we're developing today do have cultural implications, as well as the landscape and the biodiversity and the ecology and things as well. So here's one of Bob's early maps. And so he sent me these last night. He scanned them in for me and sent them, so I wanted to show some of these, this early stuff. So 1971, they produced this map showing remoteness from the nearest road based on Naismith's rule, so walking time. And then what actually looks like some early computer mapping, but isn't, it's just mapped on grid cells for the Cairngorms area. That's McCloskey and Spaulding's reconnaissance level wilderness map for the world, or the green areas that are remaining wilderness. The figure of merit there is this 37% of the world's land surface might be described as wilderness. And that's simply based on some definitive criteria, like so many miles from the nearest road, areas greater than a certain acreage, I think it was 1 million acres. And of course, we look at Scotland, well, there's nothing there. Scotland remains blank. These are some of Rob's maps. And so Rob Leslie was starting to use GIS at this point, using these more of a continuum. I mean, it's kind of classification based, but it was basic cartographic modelling, both at a national scale in terms of Australia, and also produced this global map as an addition to the McCloskey and Spaulding map, but again using GIS and global data sets, but now digitally available tactical pilotage charts in the form of digital chart of the world. Okay, so where are we on this timeline? Things have started to happen in Europe, and this side of the line is Europe. I'll put it on the slant so it's simpler, get it on the slide. Scotland's been in the game a lot longer, and so I put Bob's PhD thesis there at the top as a starting point. Then I start drawing a few maps there. And then there's a number of other people who are important here. There's Dominic Havron, did a PhD thesis in Stirling University, which I was external examiner for, looking at extrapolating GIS maps of wilderness from air photograph, photo perception work. We then, in 1999, had MPPG 14, National Planning Policy Guideline, which was about landscape, I'll mention wild land definition in a minute. I had a PhD student, Stefan Fritz, who looked at mapping wilderness in Scotland. And then this whole series of developments, which I'll come back to, but basically from this point onwards, 2002, you then have a national policy developing on land in Scotland, recognising as important right up to present day 2013. We've got some maps which are available on the web, on SNH's website, and the Scottish Government National Planning Framework 3, which mentions wild land. Meanwhile, Europe suddenly, sort of in 2009, comes up with a European Parliament resolution, which was voted, which was accepted at a massive majority, which said we've got wilderness in Europe, we need to do something about protecting it and valuing it, and to do that we need some a definition, we need some guidelines for management, but in order to underpin those, we need to be able to map it. So we need a register and we need a wilderness map. And a number of conferences come out of that, but in 2012 we had the publication of the guidelines and the definition. And only just this year, as I mentioned, we launched the Wilderness Register and the new index, special index at Wild 10. So these are some of the early maps that we've drawn. These are these ones along the top are some of the ones I drew with Stefan Fritz, looking at developing these continuum maps from the least wild location in Britain, probably London somewhere, the most wild, somewhere in the Highlands of Scotland. We were then doing some work on looking at what those areas which were protected and those which weren't. And if they don't have any kind of landscape or biodiversity protection, then perhaps we need to be a little bit concerned about those. But what we were doing was bringing together a series of maps, things like, basically maps about remoteness and naturalness. And so if you look at the work of Rob Leslie in the Australian National Wilderness Inventory, they use remoteness from mechanised access, remoteness from settlement, what they call apparent naturalness, and that's the lack of human intrusion in the landscape. So can you see a road, a building, a pylon, a dam, that sort of information. And what they call biophysical naturalness, so that's the ecological naturalness, if you like, of the vegetation and the land cover. And so some of the work which these were drawn around about 2000, something like that. Then we were producing versions of those maps, but for Scotland, using readily available data sets. A lot of these data sets actually came from the Countryside Information System. This one's a little bit different because it's apparent naturalness. I started to mess with viewshed analysis. So can you use viewsheds to calculate where human impacts are visible from? And these are all 1 kilometre resolution, so it's probably a little bit dodgy, but you get a rough idea. Add those together in a multi-criteria evaluation model, where you're simply standardising each of the inputs and then adding them together using a weighted linear summation model or something similar. You can come up with a continuum, a wilderness continuum, for this notion that I mentioned here about a continuum from most wild to least wild. So let's go back to Scotland and say we need to underpin this by some policy, and these are the quotes from the relevant quotes from the different policy documents. So NPPG 14 says uninhabited, relatively inaccessible, minimum influence of human activity on the character and quality of the environment. SNH says, okay, there are parts of the Scottish countryside where the wild character of the landscape, its related recreational value, potential for nature, should be safeguarded. And then there's a series of attributes. I'll come on to those in a minute. At the same time, the National Trust for Scotland produced a document, a policy document on wild land. And I like this definition as much as any. I think it's more lyrical. Captures the essence of wild land. It's relatively remote, inaccessible, not noticeably affected by contemporary human activity, offers high-quality opportunities to escape and the pressures of everyday living and find physical and spiritual refreshment. So there's a lot of geography in there, and then that immediately attracts to say, okay, relatively remote and accessible, we can model that. Not noticeably affected by contemporary human activity. Oh, we've got some data sets, we can have a go at modelling that as well. High quality opportunities to escape, a bit difficult, but we can start to talk about some of the issues to do with recreational opportunity spectrum here, I guess. And I guess we all intrinsically know, I mean, you know, living and working in Scotland, you're maybe hill walkers or mountaineers or whatever, you may intrinsically sort of have some some understanding of that. These are the criteria which were listed in the SNF policy document dated 2002, the attributes and the criteria. And so they talk about perceived naturalness rather than ecological naturalness, and I guess that's critical for some of the modelling that we've done subsequent to this. So it's about functioning natural habitats, unmodified catchment systems, and that's something which I'll return to at the end of the talk. Lack of constructions or other artifacts, so no buildings, etc., works, infrastructure. Little evidence of contemporary land uses, so this notion about grazing and forestry, I guess. Field sports is important for Scotland in terms of state management, so deer stalking, grouse shooting, that sort of thing. He also mentioned rugged and otherwise challenging terrain. So, obviously, Scotland is certainly the Highlands at least, very rugged landscape, striking topography, a natural setting for recreation. So we attempted to model that using terrain data. Remoteness in an access roof, this comes back to Bob's work on modelling Naismith's roof. So distance from settlement, but not just linear distance, but distance in terms of time access. And then finally, of course, is area extent, big enough to engender a feeling of remoteness and solitude. But I guess if you're modelling this, then you're talking about extent and area anyway. So the next few bits of this talk are getting a bit more technical. I'll talk you through how we model the attribute maps and their variants. So this I'm working with initially with the Cairngorm National Park through Matthew Hawkins and others there. We decided that we would model perceived naturalness of the land cover. We would model absence of modern human artifacts. We would model the rugged and challenging nature of the terrain, and we would model remoteness. And the implication is, at the end of the day, that we're talking about size and extent through some of those attributes. And then I'll talk you through how we combine those for national parks. But subsequent to doing Cairngorm National Park, and then got a contract to repeat the modelling work for Loch Lomond and the Trossachs. But also to do the southern extension to the Cairngorm National Park. And we've played around with different algorithms, particularly with multi-criteria calibration, but then through the perception survey, we're able to apply some fuzzy modelling to the results. By the way, I know Owen did say and take questions at the end. If anybody's got any burning issues or say that's rubbish or whatever, please stick your hand up and interject. I'm quite happy to do that as long as it doesn't make us drag on too long, but I can chop the talk at any particular point, really. There's a number of natural breaks in it where I can say, okay, what's going on. So perceived naturalness of land cover. Obviously, we need land cover data. The most up-to-date data we had at the time was the CEH's land cover map 2000 data. So we were using that, 25-metre resolution, derived, as you probably know, from winter and summer satellite imagery, which has been classified. And we used the broad habitat subclass information from that. You can see the categories here. And all we simply did in consultation with the landscape experts at the Cairngorm National Park was to reclassify those into naturalness classes. But then, of course, a whole series of problems throw themselves up into the air. You've got this, an incident one like with inland water. Is that a natural loch, a lochan? Or is it an impounded, is it a completely artificial impoundment, or has it had its height of a natural loch raised through imposition of some flow barrier? So, for example, this is an image from the report that we did for the Loch Lomond and the Trossachs. So you see a loch catch in there. It's a natural loch, but it's being impounded, so it's got a bit of a drawdown line around its edge, so it's slightly artificial. So if we gave it a 4, it's just like one of these things, you've got to say, well, we'll give it a class. If it was entirely natural, we'll give it the top rating. If it's impounded, it still looks natural to a lot of people, but of course the dam at the end, which is modelled separately, but if it's impounded, we gave it a 3. The other difficulties we had were with woodland, And so we used supplementary data from the Highland Birchwood Survey, which enabled us to classify woodland into degrees of naturalness, whether it was natural, semi-natural, mixed or planted. And the other difficulties we had were with the dwarf shrub heath class, so heather moorland. Is that burnt and shot over and drained, or is it as near natural as it could be? And so we used the Land Cover of Scotland 88 data because that has classes within it which describe the degree of management that is undertaken on a piece of moorland. And that diagram at the top there just attempts to illustrate that very badly because you probably can't see it, but it was an overlay of the Land Cover of Scotland classification Land Cover Map 2000. And you can see the, I don't know if this thing has a zapper on it, it does. You can see the moorbird pattern on that land very clearly, so we were able to distinguish. And we did cross-check with aerial photography to get a reasonably good representation of the perceived naturalness of land cover. This was all cross-reference with local experts as well through meetings. So we were able to generate maps. The series of maps I'm going to show you now are all based on Loch Lomond and the Trossachs National Park. So you can see the lock coming out. So apologies if you're red, green, colour blind. Is anybody red, green, and colour blind? Because we've got the spinach at the back. Obviously, these are the colours which the National Park chose. They chose the colour ramp, which is not very good for red, green, colour blind gentlemen. So apologies for that, if any of you are. So yeah, obviously the Loch comes out. Loch Lomond comes out very high in the naturalness spectrum, whereas Loch Katrine there comes out slightly less. And so what we did here is that because we're dealing with 25 by 25 metre pixels largely, we took a decision that it's a bit more than that because your personal space as you're walking through a landscape is bigger than 25 by 25 metres. So we actually did a calculation and did it within a 250 metre radius of the target point. So that's why some of the edges look a little bit fuzzy, because it tries to take into account the total perceived naturalness within your personal space, if you like. I mean, you could argue the toss about whether 250 metres is a good number or not, but we had to make a decision somewhere. The next thing we did was absence of modern human artifacts. And here we were looking at obviously things like the railway lines and all these penstocks and power lines associated with hydro developments, particularly in this area of Loch Lomond and Trossachs. And we used a viewshed model here. Now, one of the issues there is that we found out with the Cairngorm work, if we wanted to calculate the viewshed of all of the features in the park, and we were working at a nominal resolution there of 20 by 20 metre cells, and you've got an area which is 100 kilometres by 80 kilometres, do the math. If let's say ArcGIS on a reasonable machine might take 30 seconds to a minute to do one view share, and so if you've got millions of view shares, it'd still be running. So we have to develop our own software to do this. I'll show you the software in a minute. But we're able to produce these maps where the little sort of ordinal colour is where you can't see, in this instance, any roads, tracks or railways. But again, the colour scheme remains the same. The brown ends have got our low value in terms of the wildness. The green end is spectrums much higher. And we did the same for plantation forest, and buildings and structures, and pylons, cables, hydro, reservoir, drawdown lines. And then obviously put those together in a single composite map, and you can rapidly see the influence of the plantation forest in the Queen Elizabeth Forest Park there, the influence of Bob told me not to, he couldn't mention this in the guide that he wrote for the Loch Lomond Trossachs, but Fat Lane, and other places with human infrastructure. Wind energy was an issue, particularly for the Cairngorm, but also for Loch Lomond and the Trossachs. And here you can see existing installed turbines and their influence on the national park landscape. We have also repeated that for approved turbines, the turbines which have received approval but not yet been built, those which are at the application stage, and those which are at the scoping stage. We increased our view distance to 30 kilometres. I forgot to mention in the previous piece of work, we were using 15 kilometres as our maximum viewshed distance. And again, we were able to combine that to produce a composite viewshed for all feature layers and include turbines as well in that analysis. I can spend a little bit of time with viewshed too if anybody's interested. I can show you a live demo of it, since I think it's quite impressive anyway. But basically what we decided is that we simply can't do this using standard off-the-shelf software because it just takes too long. We'd all be grey hair and all by the time it actually finished running. Even if we used a distributed network, we'd have to go to the grid to produce anything sensible. So I worked with a guy in computing, a guy called Justin Washtel, to produce a fast and efficient algorithm. And we used a raycasting tool and a voxel modelling approach. So we're not doing this in raster, we're using a voxel three-dimensional volumetric pixel approach. And raycasting is a technique which we borrowed from the gaming industry, computer gaming industry. So if anybody's ever played Call of Duty 4 or something like that, obviously you've got to know where people are, objects are, in a three-dimensional, real-world, real-time space, otherwise the game just wouldn't work. And you need to know the line of sight between your gun and what your target is. And so we use that approach. And it's an approach which operates with, it has independent checking of both the, if you imagine a volumetric pixel, in a square column, a bit like, I know they're not square, but a bit like Giant's Causeway. Imagine a train model which looks like that. Then we're checking both whether the horizontal top of the pixel, I keep calling it pixels, voxel, is visible, but also its columnar sides. Not just for full, but also for partial visibility. So I'm looking for some object which I can demonstrate with. So if that's your volumetric pixel, then if it's on the top of the surface, I guess most of you can see that, all of it, but as it goes down behind a hill, we're actually still calculating the relative area visible. We use a method which reduces redundant checking, and this simply reduces runtimes by orders of about 10,000. We call the results viewshed transform, because what it's doing is producing a cross visibility from every cell to all other cells, and it just opens up a whole sphere of possibilities in terms of analysis. So what it does, if that's your starting point, it simply goes around the outside and checks the visibility of all the outside polygons, and then the intervening polygons, voxels, and if it finds something in the way, it knows then it doesn't need to calculate what's behind. Back to the Call of Duty analogy, is your computer's not rendering what cannot be seen from the point of view of the player. This approach follows a similar thing. So if it knows there's something in the way, it doesn't bother trying to calculate it. The other way it has efficiencies is it does it all in RAM. There's no disk access. So you load the terrain data first, and then your feature data, and then there's a tiling routine, and it does all the calculations in RAM, so there's no disk access. If you know anything about computer access, that would just really slow things down. There are some shortcuts which, we create fissions at the expense of some systematic error, but we think that the pros and cons outweigh the cons for large measures of grids. We compared it with a number of different other products, so ArcGIS, Saga, Idrisi, and GRASS, and they all produce comparable results in terms of the binary viewsheds. But what the other software doesn't do is it doesn't produce this partial visibility output with opposite advantages there. So this is just an indication of how it just calculates that proportionality of surfaces and edges visible, and how the future cells are occluded by this cell here, for example. You just don't bother calculating what's behind that anymore. The outputs enable us to incorporate both the plan and the profile of these voxels, but also we add distance decay in. So effectively, you imagine you're stood in a particular location. What it's calculating is calculating a full 360-degree view shed, 360-degree in vertical, but it's calculating the proportion of the features which you've input that are the proportion of the full 360-degree view shed which is occupied by one of your input features. So again, if this is a building, and that's occupying about 50% of your view shed. As you move it away, it's occupying your field of view on that view, on that object is narrowing out, both in the horizontal and the vertical. Plus, of course, it might be going behind some object in the terrain. So it's quite powerful in that respect. I'm just going to take my life in my hands and try and demo it to you now. The screenshot is just a screenshot. I'm just going to click on this. Okay, so I'm going to load an elevation map, and this is just a demo. It's a sort of real-time viewshed calculator. Anybody's interested later, I can show you the batch version. So I'm just going to load a DEM of the Cairngorm National Park. And as you can see, I don't know what machine this is. What is it? Some Pentium thing. It's quite a low machine, close-spec machine, but you can see this is an 80 by 80 metre resolution DEM of the whole of the Cairngorm National Park. I'll just move it across a bit. And you can see it's calculating view sheds real-time, so it's very, very quick. So I'm in Loch Ennick here at the moment. You can imagine there in Loch Ennick, if you know it, it's a very enclosed glacial basin with a long, thin lake in it. You can imagine being there, restricted view shed. You climb up this cliff, you're very... and then when we got on top of the ridge, all of a sudden the view shed opens up. We can specify maximum and minimum distances. So I'll just move off the map so you can see I've got a maximum distance there. Also a minimum distance. And at the moment it's just calculating whether a voxel's visible or not. So it's a binary output. And here I'll just put a distance decay effect on. So if you use a linear distance decay, it's actually giving you relative height of that object. And that object represents the voxel. You put a square and you get an area of its vertical face that's visible. And we've got a batch version where you can just throw in a load of features, calculate where those features are visible, and produce a combined output of the kind I've just been showing on the maps. There's a batch processing tool. The box is just the tile. And of course, you have to have a, if your maximum view distance is that, you've got to have a buffer around the edge so the tiling tool does all of that for you. And you can run multiple tiles over multiple machines across the network. So that was the second of the attributes. The third was this rugged and physical challenging nature of the terrain. And here we just used calculated ruggedness from the terrain data. And we did that, we said, okay, how do you do that? There were lots of different ways, but we decided that standard deviation of total curvature, so both horizontal and vertical, platform and profile curvature, was a good indication as to the degree that the terrain's doing that. In the Cairngorms, we also added a vertical factor as well based on some metadata. So obviously, an indication of the higher you are, the more likely you are to encounter bad weather, snow, ice, wind, rain, usual stuff that you find in Scotland. And then the fourth one was remoteness, and this is where, again, we applied a computer model for Naismith's rule. So we just used the path distance tool in ArcGIS and implemented a version of Naismith's rule. Anybody know Naismith's rule? One or two nodding. Yeah, so it's 5 miles an hour on the flat and out half an hour for every 1,000 feet of climbing. And then there's Langmuir's correction, which takes off 10 minutes for every 1,000 feet of descent in the angles between 5 and 12 degrees or something, and then you add on 10 minutes if it's greater than 12 degrees, because I guess you've got to pick your way more carefully. So we use Naismith's rule with Langmuir's correction. And we were able to incorporate barrier features into that. So open water, big rivers which you would need a bridge to cross, steep ground greater than 45 degrees, where you have to cut off the threshold of setting script at 45 degrees and do a hill walk if you're going to go around it. We also incorporated ground cover data as well, so if you're walking on nice flat grass sward, it's very easy and you can do that 5 miles an hour on the flat, but if it's dense heather or bog or dense forest, then that's going to slow you down. So we incorporated cost factors into that, so we just did that in ArcGIS path distance function. And flipping between those two maps, we also, this was the summer map, but then we had this discussion with the National Park people that said, well, it gets different in the winter when a lot of these burns, these rivers are in spate, so you can see a difference. So as I flip between those two. And then we just simply again put them together as in a multi-criteria evaluation model. Again, just using equal weights, because that's what the National Park wanted. They didn't want to make any judgments as to which of these attributes were more important than others. But of course we start thinking about that and say, well, actually that's probably not realistic. And if I asked each of you in this room to come up with a ranking or a weighting or whatever, assigning priorities to each of those four attributes of remoteness, naturalness, absence of human artifacts and ruggedness, you'd probably come up with slightly different weightings. So what we did was with the national parks is we developed a perception survey. And so this was done through Wotlam and Trossachs National Park with Cairngorm and SNH involved. We did an online survey using MVA consultants with an online community. I can't remember what it's called now, but they basically pay people vouchers to do these online surveys, and they're able to select a representative demography across the whole of Scotland, and then they zoomed in to the national parks and had a selection of people in the national parks. But I think we had about 1,100 respondents to this. It's a reasonable sample as these surveys go. And what we did was a best-worst model. We're asking people about questions like about which of these descriptions is most likely to endear a sense of wildness. We'll show them some photographs, and they have to choose the best, the worst, and you take those, the best and the worst away, and you're left with three, and they have to choose the next best and the next worst, and of course you take those away, you're left with the middle one. And so on the basis of that, we were then able to derive some weights, normalised weights for ruggedness, seed naturalness, absence of artifacts, remoteness. We also included wildlife in that, because initial surveys, people say, oh, wildlife is what really makes it feel wild to us. You know, I can appreciate that. I've been in bear country, I've been in polar bear country, and that really does make the hair on the back of your neck stand up and see big footprints in the snow. And we don't have any big creatures like that in Scotland, no top predators anymore. But people were adamant that the presence of wildlife, so I'm guessing in Scotland, we're talking about red deer and other animals like that, like the golden eagle, we'll come back on them later, are indicative of some sense of wildness. But we weren't able to map that particularly well, so we just stripped that out of our weights. We were able to get some nominalised weights. So this is a map for the Loch Lomond and Trossachs, weighted by Scotland's Scottish resident weights. And if you flip between that and the relative weights, you see there's a little bit of a difference. The main underlying pattern remains the same, unsurprisingly, but the detail changes. Of course, this is all very well and good, and for a long time, I avoided the notion of putting lines on these maps. You know, we have a continuum there, it's informative, it tells us where the least wild place is, it tells us where the most wild place is, it gives us an indication of relative wildness. But for a long time I said, I'm not going to put a line on this map, because depending on the weights, depending on how you model the attributes, depending on your own personal perceptions, that line, and anyway, it's a fuzzy notion, is wilderness wildland, you know, it's not a measurable thing. So, you know, put a line on a map is really awkward, really difficult, really kind of, creating hostage to fortune. But I'm a kind of pragmatic kind of guy, and I realised that no matter what strong arguments you make about these kind of maps, saying, well, these are map of wildness and heartfelt pleas about protecting wild land. That's never going to cut any ice with the planners, the decision makers, the politicians, the economists, the developers. They need a line on the map. And so we started to work with Robert Moran, because he'd already developed a typology of wild land based on these attributes of wildness and the degree to which they're modified. And we thought, well, okay, we can combine that with the GIS data, with some fuzzy modelling, and the weights that we got from the perception survey to develop some fuzzy maps. So we're taking these individual attributes and their data ranges for the different parks and developing these fuzzy membership functions for the support and belief functions for being not wild and wild, and then as a result of being able to define where you start moving from the not wild into the wilder, or you start moving from the edge into the wild land, we're able to then define the intermediate or the moderate wildness fuzzy membership function in the centre. So we did some of this, and we based it around some sort of off the back of the envelope calculations with some experts, and we're able to then start to develop these maps showing membership for core wildness. So again, the same spectrum, green is full support, brown is low support, but critically we're able to define the black areas, these areas that look like they've burnt, are no support. So there's no support in the model for that being wild land. In the buffer zone, things are a little bit more complicated. You imagine that's that middle tent shape function. In the periphery zone, so there's no support for these core wild land areas being called periphery. And of course you're able to then combine those in a simple Boolean map to define core, buffer and periphery zones. We experimented with a number of different ways of doing this, using these Boolean models, using Dempster-Shafer, using fuzzy set theory, etc. But more or less coming up with similar kinds of answers. But again, if we use the weights, you see different patterns. So this is the membership, the belief function for core wildness using Scottish residence weights, the buffer zone, the periphery zone. And again, by Boolean combination, you can produce a different map. And I'm just flipping between the two, and you see big differences. Now this creates a problem, just for me anyway, because I'm always worried that handing over these maps to Cairngorm National Park or whoever are going to use it in a public inquiry basis and say, no, you can't build that wind farm there because some smart-ass lawyer's going to come around and say, Carla, how did you define that map? I go, well, I did this. And they say, well, why did you do that? Why did you use that way? Why did you... I think it's a legal nightmare. How are we doing for time? A couple of minutes. I'll just show you the European maps. So we've talked about that. We did a similar thing for the whole of Europe. But here we try to incorporate potential natural vegetation. So this is a combination between Corin land cover map and a potential natural vegetation map. And if you've ever come across a potential natural vegetation map, it's just what would be there if humans weren't in the landscape. So if we hadn't, plowed up the land and cut down the forest, given roughly current climatic conditions. So we compared these two maps. Said how natural is that vegetation. We also incorporated grazing density because that's a big impact, and all of a sudden you start to see big impacts in Scotland there in terms of grazing densities. That enabled us to give us a potential natural vegetation, naturalism vegetation. We can combine that with remoteness from settlements, with remoteness from access from main roads, produce a wilderness map. And this is a map that we've launched just recently. This is Europe's brand new formal official wildness map, wildness index. And not surprisingly, you can see a strong latitudinal gradient. The further north you go, the less human impact and the more natural the land cover, because there's less potential for agriculture. Also, there's a strong, in the southern, central Europe, there's a strong altitudinal aspect. So the Alps, the Pyrenees, the Carpathians, etc., they all stand out as being wilder. Plus you've got this kind of northwest Celtic fringe going on as well. Because the temptation then is to top slice, produce these maps with percentage wildness. And quite gratifyingly, there are some bits in Scotland there. Notice these are the areas greyed out, the areas which were unable to return category A wilderness according to the European Wilderness Guidelines. So areas with no extractive land use, so no hunting, basically most of them. And then we did this kind of repeated the protected, not protected again. So Cairngorms are protected, and other areas protected under the N2K is the TUA 2000 and the CDDA data sets. And of course, it's the yellow area that immediately drawn to attention that all the attributes of wildness are not protected in any way. Finally, just sort of mention the Scottish National map. The document in 2002 had these rough areas drawn on it. And as I understand it, this was Mark Wrighton and John Mackay sat in a pub somewhere with a map going there. We intrinsically know that these are the core wildland areas. Intrinsically, anybody with any knowledge of Scotland will probably come up with a similar kind of a map. But it's just based on local knowledge. So, recent work basically took the Cairngorm and the National Park mapping and developed a civil map for Scotland. Recently they've just gone into a phase 2 and phase 3 where they identified the largest and the most wild areas, and then phase 3 was added some local judgment to draw some coherent boundaries around. So there's the national map, and there's the core areas, the new core areas map, which is now out for consultation. And they just use the same kind of model as we use for the national parks. But I do like that quote from Stokes and Morrison there, that conservation values rarely black and white, more often they're shades of grey, and that underpins this whole notion of a continuum. We use 256 shades of grey rather than 50, that's our map. What they did then was try top slicing, and that didn't work very well, so they then took the histogram of wildness and they applied 8 Jenks classes. So if you've ever done this in ArcGIS, you can slice up your data using natural breaks, using the Jenks method, and that produced this map. And these lines here are national scenic areas, the national parks, and the old search areas for wild land, and it's a pretty good correlation. And that's where they ended up with that map. If you compare, and this is of interest for me in terms of scaling, you compare what work we did for the John Muir Trust with the SNH wildness map, and this map here is the EU EEA map. There's not a particularly good correlation here, and I can talk to you later about that if you want, but basically it was down to national accessibility to population, which skewed it towards the islands and the Highlands of Scotland. But this map and this map, it's quite a pleasing correlation. Although, of course, the data set's different. This is 50 metre resolution, and this is 1 kilometre resolution. There's got to be some big differences. Further work, future directions, well, I want to continue the work on the viewshed modelling. If anybody wants to use that viewshed software, by the way, let me know and see what we can do. We do license it out for use. And I'm currently doing a complete viewshed analysis of the whole of the UK's land cover data at 50 metre resolution to produce a land character assessment. My 18-year-old's helping with that, and he's gaming the machine in his spare time. The other thing I'm working on is this catchment-based. Remember I mentioned catchment-based models? The US has a Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. Why don't we have a similar kind of model idea for Scotland? And this is just some preliminary outputs I presented last week in Salamanca, in that I've taken the SEPA catchments and I've mapped wildness attributes from the Scottish data on a catchment basis, so mean, maximum, min. But then they thought, scratch your head and think, well, how do these then accumulate? If anybody's done any hydrological modelling, you can put a weight layer in. How does that accumulate through the catchment downstream? So how wild is upstream? And of course we can develop those kind of models doing that. This is some viewshed work that we did just looking at the areas where you could potentially build new wind turbines without them impinging on the core wildland areas. So these light green areas are core. The non-coloured areas are the only places you could build new turbines. So there's a few little patches up here, a big chunk of land in Aberdeenshire, and bits in the southern upland. Cultural aspects, I did say I'd mentioned that, but going back to Bob's comment about empty biodiversity, this is all very interesting, but we need to sort of look at this in a cultural aspect. Some of the work we did for the last Wild Conference, Wild 9, showed that, yes, indeed, a lot of these areas we now call wild land were the basis of a cropping lifestyle community, but there are other places that aren't. There's, according to the archaeological evidence anyway, there's been nobody living there. People have been there, of course, but there was nobody living there. And scaling issues. I think you know this robustness of the model, because we're making these decisions, and if anybody's got thoughts and concerns, I'd really like to hear those. Anyway, that's it. They should have done that 10 minutes ago. Tell me, shut up.
So there's pressure also now increasingly on coastal regions, you know, farming, salmon farms and the rest of it.
Yeah.
How readily do you think you could take this kind of methodology and apply it to coastal areas?
We've done some work on coastal modelling because coasts are interesting, and this is actually put that on the list of further things, but I was working with James Tricker for the JMT. He now works at the Leopold Institute in Missoula. And we were looking particularly at coastal accessibility. And when you're on the coast, and this is something we did for the, I didn't mention it, but for the Loch Lomond and Trossachs National Park, you could use combined travel methods. So walking combined with a canoe or whatever, you know, so you can paddle across these lakes. Some of the lakes have water taxis on, as you know. And so we incorporated that into our remoteness models. So yeah, remoteness is relatively easy to handle, and it can make a big difference in places which doesn't have a coastal margin road. So getting into some of the remote sea locks and things like that, it's a lot quicker to use a sea kayak. And so if you combine a sea kayak with your walking model, you can keep your model that to some extent. The visual impact from salmon farms, for example, is more difficult to handle because, as you know, they kind of move around, and they do move them around, and so they're not fixed. And so we did have a long discussion with Loch Lomond and the Trossachs National Park and with SNH when we did the national work as to whether to include those, and the decision was not to because we couldn't pin them down spatially. They're mobile and moving. So anything that's temporal, you know, is there 1 minute and not the next, is a difficult one. But we could incorporate an element of that with a rough polygon and say, we know there are some fish farms in this area. Remoteness to the islands is another issue with the national map, one which I was talking to Catherine Harry about it last week, in that not fully got the measure of that problem yet. Because what we assumed with the national map is that if there's a public ferry and a public road, we could model it as we would normally on the mainland. But if access to those islands is by private boat or independent means, then it's a little bit more difficult. And we didn't want to skew it, the remoteness stuff, towards the island communities because you know, there are cultural sensitivities there and they wouldn't want to be deemed, you know, on the edge where, you know, so we just need to be a little wary of that.
Have you done any correlation between land tenure and wilderness? Because, what's it, 432 people own half of Scotland.
Yes.
So in some ways your maps, the common maps, reflect the land tenure system in Scotland. Is that true?
To some extent, yes, because, and this is, you know, what I was alluding to with the cultural sensitivities and what Bob was saying, like, oh, you know, it's not empty, it's empty. We've done some work with land ownership data with JMT, and it's a little bit sensitive because what we did is we took the top 10% wildland and we got data from Who Owns Scotland to overlay that on the top 10% wildland and say, well, who is it that owns this land? And we literally created a traffic light map which said green, amber, red. And we green for wildland friendly, amber for we weren't quite sure, and red for definitely antagonistic. And that was an interesting map, but it was very fractious. I haven't shown it. Actually, it was one that you usually get a data set from some organisation and say you can use this for the project, and then you've got to delete it afterwards. Does anybody ever do that? I don't. I always keep it in the background somewhere. But this was one data set I did delete, so I don't have that map anymore because I didn't want it, because it's quite a difficult political problem to deal with.
And Andy Wayne would love it.
Oh, well, it was Andy Wayne when we got the data up. So he knows about it. He's probably got it somewhere. Maybe he did keep it. But yeah, you can look into those core wildland areas that are in the official wildland map. They're out for consultation now. And the people who are kicking off about them are obviously the renewable energies companies, but also the estate managers, that 400 and whatever Tweedy gentleman from the south, or from countries far away who own this from Scotland, and they're going, this is a resource sterilisation issue as far as they're concerned. So it becomes a bit of a political hot potato, and that's simply because they put boundaries on the map. But you need the boundaries in order to develop the landscape protection mechanisms, make decisions.
Thanks so much for your talk, really enjoyed it.
Okay.
At one point you talked about public perceptions of the kind of association of wildlife with wildland.
Yep.
One of the definitions I think that John, your trust used to use in the past was very fly, they used kind of range indicator for wildland.
Yep. I didn't put that slide in. I had to put it down somehow. It was probably too many slides enough as it was anyway. But I wanted to include a quote, a personal communication with Dick Balharry. If anybody knows Dick Balharry, the naturalist who was part of the JMT, but he would often say to me, he says, Steve, you don't need your maps. You just need to know where the eagle is. That's the wild land. You know? Sorry, Dick, that's probably not a very good impersonation. That's what he always used to say to me, and there's this perception that where golden eagles are is a good indicator for wildness, because they need all of the qualities of wildness to successfully rear a brood. But it is about nest locations, and I've tried to get that information so many times from the Scottish Raptor Monitoring Group, and they just don't want to know. I've even said, here's my maps, you analyse it with your data and let's look at the correlation. And they said no to that as well. And of course, the sensitivities are about egg collectors, but also persecution from land managers. I think the land manager thing's a bit of a red herring, because they know where all the eagle nests are anyway, because they're in the land and of the land. But it's the egg collectors, I suppose, which is the difficult one. Rob McMorran, that's why I wish he was here, has just got hold of that data, or some of that data. So we are going to start looking at that. But you could use other species, I suppose. But again, the data's not brilliant. And most of those species which you might use as indicators, Scottish wildcat, pine marten, other raptors have been persecuted to the point of extinction in a lot of places. And so wildland in Scotland is a landscape thing. If you start looking at biodiversity and ecological naturalness, you've got a very bitty kind of map at the end of the day, which will say places like the islands on Loch Maree are quite often pointed out and saying, this is what the natural vegetation maybe look like. Take point. It's a difficult one.
My question is very similar, actually.
It's
a
similar
kind of question. So you kind of ended on that point. My question was, you're using the maps to prioritize areas to potentially safeguard or treat as particularly unique or special, and you can have a really degraded, non-natural site very close to a city that might be really important for its ecological function. So I just wondered, in terms of prioritizing, where we spend our limited funds, or as a political tool or policy formulation tool, then I wonder if it's sort of excluding really important habitats for other reasons.
Again, if I'd have more time, I could have explained that process, and this is a thought process which we're SNH are going through at the moment. When they did that, defining core wildland areas, the way that they did it is say they took the Jenks classes and they identified classes, there were eight classes. Classes 8 and 7 were core wildland, 7 and 5 were edge, you know, they represented the buffer zone between non-wild and wild. And then they said, okay, let's isolate all those at more than 1,000 hectares. And of course, immediately, nothing in the southern uplands, nothing lower, you know, around Glasgow, Edinburgh, Central Belt just disappeared. So they lowered the size threshold to 500 hectares, and then you got back some of those areas which are closer to Glasgow and Edinburgh and are in the southern uplands. So yes, there's that into account. Personally, I'm thinking about redrawing some of the maps using a sort of geographically weighted regression type approach. So you've got some, if you use population density or access to population as a control variable, then you can weight your maps accordingly. So as you get close to urban areas, then remoteness and absence of modern human artifacts in the view become less important, and maybe naturalness and ruggedness become more important. And vice versa, as you're in more remote areas, then it's remoteness and absence of modern human artifacts which become more important. So you're weighting your layers via an independent weighting factor, which might be access to population.
Yeah, can I just add to that, because I think that's absolutely crucial, because you said during the presentation you didn't want to draw lines around the map, because what you didn't want to do was stand at a public inquiry and defend against a shit-hot QC saying, why did you do that?
Yeah.
Right? And that's the problem here with what we're talking about, because some poor guy might well have to stand up at a public inquiry and justify an objection to a wind farm based on your data. And of course, as soon as it's like climate change, as soon as you start to get into modelling, then you know the whole thing just gets completely weird.
But
I think what that's on the one side, but I think what the great thing is what you've just described, because in relation to that urban fringe, what you can do is change your model. So you can say, right, actually, round Glasgow, round Edinburgh, we're not talking about core wildlands. What we're talking about is a different perception of what is valuable to the citizenry. So you can change your model and you can come up with some kind of value of land around Glasgow, which, you know, is really, really important for the citizens of Glasgow, but you know, it's not your core wildland model, but it's equally valid. It's an equally valid model.
I mean, you can even take it inside the city and look at those little green patches of, you know, land, whatever they are, and they're really important for, you know, informal recreation. You know, take the dog for a walk, evening or whatever. You know, like Edinburgh, I suppose, out of the city, because you know, there's a really important places locally within Edinburgh's boundary. I guess the Pentlands as you look a little bit further, and etc. But if you want that real hardcore wildland experience, then you go to the northwest on the Cairngorm or whatever. But yeah, it's. And when I said I don't want to have to stand up in front of a QC, I'm not looking forward to it. I guess at some point it may well happen. But yeah, you end up. I mean, it's bad enough talking to you guys, a bunch of experts on GIS, and you're firing questions at me, you know, but imagine what that would feel like with some lawyer picking stuff out. Yeah, it's really difficult. I mean, one thing we did do, and this was based at an SNH conference at Battleby, is people broke out into separate groups to look at some of the early core maps, and on the back of that, I gave people a list of attributes, and I said, can you select top 5 of these attributes and then rank them? And so you had, I think it was about 70-odd people involved in 7 groups, I think. And so I drew separate wildland continuum maps based on their choices of attributes and weights. They weren't the same maps as SNH used. But then combined those maps And what we found is there's a strong agreement as what is the car, what are the core wildland areas. There's a strong agreement of the areas which aren't, but it's the bit in the middle which is where people disagree. It's that movable boundary, which...
Can I just say that if you went back to, what was it, the Ramsey Report back in the 1940s, which was the recommended areas of Scottish National Parks, pretty well guarantee it will match your wildland areas.
Probably very right. As it is, I mean, they're not a bad match for the NSAs, but the NSAs are...
Richard.
Yeah, they don't have much bite. They don't have much funding. But NSA is the best match we have at the moment, plus the national, two national parks.
One final question. Move on to Europe, to your Europe map. I was looking at Iceland, which I know quite well, and the highest vegetation score was for that year called the
highest naturalness. no vegetation, but the highest naturalness.
And then large parts of the areas that were sort of natural were actually, I think, heavily eroded, lots of soil erosion. So they're not
in that top,
the northeast.
The top northeast where that finger of hand is.
So there are areas that are actually very unnatural, and their wilderness is wilderness in a bad way.
Yeah.
So there's no quality to the. They're a long way from anyone and things, but that doesn't give a quality of. So the areas need to be restored. So
if
they don't have vegetation, which isn't natural,
there was a lot of sheep grazing in that top, in the left hand, literally it looks like a hand jutting out.
And that's a funny definition of wilderness.
Yeah, but it's kind of been created by overgrazing and the erosion you're talking about. The same in, if you look at the maps, the same in like northern Corsica. I mean, that was the bread and basket of France, but they just agriculture just destroyed the soil cover, and now it's a virtual desert. You know, I was there a couple of years ago, and that stands out strongly. A lot of other areas where similar kinds of, they're in a way they're secondary wilderness, they're manufactured wilderness.
So can this be used in a way to identify these areas they shouldn't be necessarily protected? There's something,
nice to be restored.
You see that they're trying to reduce the soil erosion.
Rewilding is a whole new area. Don't stop go. We could talk forever about that, but absolutely. You know, they're not decision making tools. They're decision support tools at the end of the day, like most other GIS maps. But the data set, we are limited with the data sets we have available, and so if we had those kind of historic data sets for the whole of Europe, we could use them. One of the key ones we didn't have was forest management. There's no unified data set on degrees of forest management. So a lot of those areas, particularly in southern Scandinavia, are intensively managed forests. And yet we didn't have any data sets which covered the whole of Europe, which would allow us to incorporate that into the model. Although you go to Scandinavia itself, and of course they are top dog foresters, and they have all of that information. So we could, at a country level, do that kind of mapping within Scandinavia, but we didn't have it for the rest of Europe, so we made that decision to keep it out of the model because we didn't want to start creating patches of data. Didn't really do that. Yeah, good point.
Yes, we're just about 2 minutes or a minute and a half to go before Geo drinks, official hour. So when you retire to a nearby TV, it might be bar for further discussion and possible questions over the part of the process. And Karen, before we all do the various thank yous, when we file out what we'll do, we'll get across there, if we can just request you all to exit by the main door there, the side door there, and we'll get the stuff out back and we'll all be over in time. So, GeoDrex, follow in the TV Library Bar across the CrossFit TV. And we'll see you there shortly. Just remains to say thanks to all the new volunteers for helping, and thanks to Blair, especially last night.